Hi, folks. This is James French.
Ted Diamond here.
And you're listening to The Awareness Connection, a podcast where we talk about mind-body awareness, health, and human development. And today we're going to be continuing our discussion, our multi-episode discussion of the subject of developmental movement. And we've gone into the history. We've gone into some of the theory of this phrase, some of the varied usage that's been made of it. We've gone into evolutionary history. And today we're really going to dive into, Ted, how you make use of it, how you make use of it, not just theoretically, but practically with students and with your own daily practice. What things can be done, the fact that this is, that you can actually make of this fruitful, useful practice, what the goals are. And we're just going to be talking about that today. So, sort of like a discussion about the practice. We're going to have to maybe not do a lot of demonstrations today because, we have a lot of listeners on audio only platforms. But yeah, it'll be more or less a practical discussion today. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Yeah, we are doing a free online class starting on the 20th of October. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we're offering at the Diamond Institute a series. It's going to be 6 classes, totally free, open enrollment, to really dive into like the practice that's to be made out of developmental movement. We'll be doing a theoretical discussion as well about why it could be effective, what we're looking for, its relationship to things like the postural mechanism, and which this upcoming course, it's going to start October 20th, 2025. But that's sort of a brief course, and it's sort of a taste of a much longer course that we're going to be offering in the spring of 2026. It's going to be something like an 8 or 10 week really deep dive into this subject, especially the practical.
Yeah, we're preparing a curriculum for that. This is sort of a preamble. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I thought, James, for as a practical, to look at this from the practical point of view, when it's sort of well known in stress theory that the autonomic system, the fight flight mechanism of the autonomic nervous system, when it's triggered, one of the things that will help to restore the parasympathetic or quieting down response of the nervous system is to relax muscles, to be quiet. This is an example of developmental movement because it's so easy to simply recommend a particular position or form of relaxation or breathing exercise to quiet down the nervous system. But all of those things, those practices or exercises are abstractions from really the fact that we are returning to a developmentally more primitive or infantile state. Mm. So if you are, if you need to quiet down and lower the activity of the nervous system and you lie face down on the ground, that's a primitive infantile posture that will help to restore more parasympathetic function. If you are holding your breath, and many of us really are holding our breath habitually because we're using too much tension, and that means we're interfering with breathing. And you pay attention to your breathing, let's say by just noticing the air going in and out through your nostrils, that will help to restore natural breathing. That also is a developmental movement. Mm-hmm. Because when you're lying on your belly and you've stopped and given yourself a chance to be quiet, you're going to breathe normally. And when you pay attention to that region, which is a very primitive, it's sort of like the front end region of the vertebrate, all vertebrates, then you're, again, you're doing something that's developmentally primitive that restores more natural function. Mm-hmm. So it tells us two things. First, it tells us why developmental movement makes sense of a field that tends to be kind of full of gimmicks and hacks and practices, but doesn't have a kind of a coherent theory. It gives us a little more of an idea of where, of how we can establish a more coherent theory. And secondly, it gives us an actual, it's an example of a very practical procedure that we can intelligently apply for helping to restore normal natural function.
All right.
And yep. There's one of your very basic, developmental procedures. Lie on your belly, face down, like an infant would, with your head turned to one side. You can have limbs advanced on that side, so you're in that kind of reptilian posture like this on the ground.
Yeah.
Or you could just lie, if you're comfortable, the nose gets in the way, but you could lie with your forehead, or you could support parts of the body, let's say the forehead, you could lie face down. Or even like a fetal position, but all these sort of prone face down positions are very, very supported, are flooding you with all kinds of healthy sensory feedback because you have so much skin surface in contact with the ground. That's a very primitive and very helpful developmental posture.
Okay.
So there's a good kind of starting point.
Yeah, so this is sort of making, like, you know, instead of telling somebody that they just need to relax or that they, this is something other than telling people to take a hot shower. This is, getting into how the body functions, how it's shaped, what sensory feedback the body can have provided to itself. You know, you can sort of provide yourself with a lot of sensory feedback just by laying down in like a strategic way.
If you look at it the other way, you know, standing on two feet is very, very complex, very advanced, and we have much less, far fewer points of support. I mean, even compared to a four-footed animal, going up on your hind limb, there are other bipeds besides humans, but humans are a biped that has gone completely vertical. We're completely, everything is stacked on top of everything else. That's a very complex posture that doesn't give us a lot of support, and it doesn't give us a lot of feedback. When you're in a prone position, you have full support, total body support, and you are flooded with all kinds of sensory feedback because you have so much skin contact. And we don't think of that as being a factor in why we relax, but it's a huge factor. Mm-hmm. It's why we get a massage or like being touched. When your side of your head is in contact with the ground, that's a very key sensory area of input that's served by one of the key cranial nerves. You're getting all kinds of sensory input in this very primitive frontal part of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're not talking simply about regression, or we're not romanticizing the idea that we could become children again, or that if we somehow recapitulate this phase of our development, it's going to sort of put us back in touch with some part of us that's more primitive and more natural. It's actually utilizing a more primitive posture to access functions at a conscious level. So we're also not just practicing a method that helps us relax without really being informed. Now we can actively become informed. So when you're lying on the ground, face down with your head turned, and you have that input, you could notice it. That's something we do every night when we're lying in bed, but we don't actively, consciously process what that is. And you can notice if you're breathing freely through your nostrils, which will help to restore natural breathing. So now we're actually engaging in an educational process, and the developmental movement is giving us a means of doing that in a very kind of systematic, way that's also just very useful and helpful. And it's just a good, something, it's something I do a bit of every morning when I start out my day, just being quiet. Yeah, so there's one really, you know, I think the sensory input part of developmental movement is really one really key part. And there's one other we could talk about in a minute, but I thought I'd mention that one.
Yeah. And I, you know, we were talking a little bit about this before, but I like that discussion right there. You know, I like that use of it because your use of a primitive posture like this, for the simple reason that that we're sort of flooding ourselves with sensory input and making use of maybe some amount of relaxation that happens, it doesn't rely on a larger theory, like say regression in service of progression, or like it doesn't rely on recapitulating, the theory that like recapitulating certain developmentally primitive movements is going to like reprogram the nervous system or the brain. You know, this is sort of making very simple use of touch, of skin contact, of tactile sensation, and it's not laden with theory.
Well, it's not laden with a false theory. Yeah, it's not laden with a false theory or a romanticized theory.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned to you before we started the podcast, James, that when we speak about, a lot of stress theory lately has been, you know, refers to another cranial nerve, the vagus nerve.
Mm-hmm.
And its relationship to the autonomic nervous system. But arguably the trigeminal nerve is even more important because we can consciously access that information when we're in a supported position with our head contacting the ground. And yet we don't hear about that because the concept of the vagus nerve and the relation to the autonomic nervous system is based on really what amounts to a kind of simplistic empirical, feedback, empirical, foundation for lowering stress. We know that if you, receive a massage, it will lower stress, but that doesn't tell us much about how stress operates.
Yeah.
But the autonomic nervous system is in a sense regulated by the natural working of the muscular system. And when we actually give ourselves feedback so we can leave everything alone and stop, and having that feedback is a very good way to start that process, then we have actually a more grounded theory about how stress actually operates and how to actually control it.
Could you say that again, Ted? You said your formulation just now was the action of the muscles is regulated by the autonomic nervous system, or was it the opposite? Was it the converse?
Kind of the converse.
Yeah, the converse. So like the function of the autonomic nervous system is embedded within the context of the function of the musculoskeletal system.
Yeah. The nervous system acts in service of action.
Mm.
Or non-action, in which case we need to restore vegetative function like digestion.
Mm-hmm.
And if we are overly active, then the nervous system can't quiet down. But conversely, if you know how to quiet the muscular, the motor system, then the nervous system will quiet down.
Yeah.
That's actually a much more robust theory about stress than a theory that just says, "Hey, we've tested out the effects of a breathing method and find that if you practice nostril breathing, it's going to lower stress." Well, that's great, but it doesn't tell me how it works, why it works that way, and most importantly, it doesn't tell me, it doesn't enlighten me as to the possibility of gaining real control and knowledge about it. But if you know how to balance the nervous, the motor system, that is a real educational approach to stress.
That's a really interesting way of putting it, Ted. That's a, you know, the fact that you said that it's a more robust theory. You know, the motor system, which is a broader conception even than the musculoskeletal system, it's, you know, the movement apparatus, the motor system. This is the thing, this is what we personally seem to have control over. You know, it's, you know, if, I mean, if we can learn how to have intelligent control over the motor system, then it'll have knock-on effects, as opposed to going right for, you know, like a lot of people are talking these days about, you know, going right for the nervous system. You know, you want to calm your nervous system down, or, you know,
relaxing muscles.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, relaxing muscles doesn't give me control, number one, but it also doesn't tell me how it works.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why does relaxing muscles, why is that associated with lowered stress?
Yeah.
Because lowered stress is associated with a more balanced, toned condition of the muscle, of the motor system.
Mm-hmm.
It's the natural balanced working of the motor system that regulates stress, not just relaxing. I mean, if relaxing is good, have a couple of martinis and sit in a hot tub, you know?
Yeah. You know?
So might lower your stress, but it's not good for you.
Yeah.
You know, it begs the question how we control stress and how stress is actually regulated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it makes me think also, like, you know, people make a lot of use of certain muscles as being more important than other muscles. Like, you know, you hear a lot about the, you know, the psoas muscle. This is sort of like, you know, it's kind of fashionable, or it has been fashionable, to talk about the psoas muscle and how important it is. And like relaxing the psoas muscle is going to have all these effects, but it doesn't really tell you about like what, you know, there's a suggestion about the function of the psoas muscle within the larger musculoskeletal system. But what about the design of the whole musculoskeletal system itself? You know, like how does that whole thing work?
You know? What about the deeper postural muscles that need to be active and the fast twitch muscles that need to be less active if we're being quiet? What about that? There you're talking about a proper balance.
Yeah.
And again, you know, a trick, so releasing one muscle is a trick. It doesn't explain how it works.
Yeah. 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 It doesn't explain how the whole thing works. No. And we're, you know, people are finding that like movement is beneficial for, you know, I mean, of course, blood flow, but also it seems like muscle contraction releases endorphins and, you know, like all these sort of beneficial effects. And so how can that be the case if movement and activity is so good for us and builds strength or keeps strength up and all of these other chemical effects and like neurological effects, and yet it's overactivity and there's also this like relationship of we get stressed with all this activity
and then
we have to relax. So if it's so good for us, what's causing stress? There's a, you know, the missing link is seems to be sort of like, what's the design of the thing and how are we making use of it in activity? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, we don't have a kind of a unified coherent theory, and we don't realize how everything, all these contradictory elements.
Yeah.
People are encouraged to be active all the time in terms of not being sedentary. Mm-hmm. And then they're trying to be sedentary in terms of trying to relax. And now you've got these conflicting pieces. And then you have this is sort of inductive modern science where you just have an amalgam of just tons of different bits of information, half of which conflict with the other half, you know.
Yeah.
It's not a very coherent or unified theory. Meanwhile, there is, in fact, a way in which the motor system needs to be active, and we know how that works. And there's a way in which it needs to be quiet and balanced, and we know how that works. And the two things are not far from being, you know, in conflict. They're part of the same system.
Mm. And so developmental movement for you, you're you're carrying forward this this phraseology, developmental movement itself. You know, you're carrying the subject along, but embedding it within this context that you just said. You know, how is the whole thing designed to function? How are we making use of it? Can it malfunction? What happens when it does? What does relaxation truly mean? Mm-hmm. Does it mean anything? Is it useful? And then going forward with our talk today, what practical methods are actually helpful, aren't overly laden with incorrect theories, are examples of a more unified theory of motor function. Mm.
Yeah. Well, should we look at another practical part?
Yeah. I think looking at the practical helps to illuminate what you're talking about, you know?
Yeah. Well, the first one we just mentioned is being quiet and getting all that sensory feedback. That's really useful and important. And there, again, there's another part of it that we, you know, discount, but when you have a lot of that contact, that's really good for the nervous system. When you feel the side of your head, whole parts of your trunk, parts of your arm, leg, all contacting the floor, we're talking about skin surface. We're not even talking about movement. We're talking about contact from the peripheral, you know, the outer integument, you know, skin layer, which is so invested deep, you know, with a sensory input. Very good for the nervous system. But another really critical piece of developmental movement is if you're lying on the floor, let's say in a prone position, in that quiet state, it's pretty easy to notice if you, let's say, try to move an arm, slide an arm along the floor, how quickly you'll want to tighten the whole shoulder girdle. You could even do that here if you're sitting at a desk, as we are, right? Mm-hmm. And you, if you're, let's say, holding your arms in the air, pretty hard to be aware of what you're doing with the shoulder. Your shoulder is quite active if you're holding your arm in the air. And in that active state, like the whole deltoid muscle will be active here just to keep the arm. And in that state, it's very hard to notice what you're doing with your shoulder and not particularly constructive. What are you going to do? Try to relax some group of muscles, some particular muscle? You can't. If in contrast, you place your whole hand and forearm on the table so that with the support of your arm on the table, you'll notice your shoulder gets much less active. Those deltoid muscles, not hard, now it's soft because it's not having to actively maintain the support of the arm. Mm-hmm. And in that quieter state, the shoulder now becomes more sensitive. The whole shoulder joint, the muscles acting on the shoulder, the rotator cuff and the deltoid, all these muscles around the joint. And if you begin now just to move your arm along the table, just slide your arm, you'll feel that those muscles tighten up immediately.
Yeah.
Developmental movement is a way of, by assuming very supported positions, it's a way of lowering the amount of activity and giving yourself much more active feedback so that when you begin to initiate a movement, like moving the arm, you can notice when you tighten. Mm-hmm. And in this way, heighten your kinesthetic awareness and control so that you can find a way to actively move the arm without doing so much of that unnecessary tightening. So that if you now explore it a little bit, you'll find that it's possible to use the whole shoulder easily without tightening that whole area. So there's another element in developmental movement, which is it gives you a means of exploring how we interfere and unnecessarily tighten muscles.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it gives us a glimpse. Like a compare and contrast mode, you know, you're not only supporting the forearm in order for the muscles to release. I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing, you know, but you're investigating, how you do something, you know, and it's, you know, that something is a very simple thing. It's just sort of moving your forearm or, you know, your hand and forearm along the table, but you're investigating how you do it. And you're saying, you know, like not only do the muscles contract, but they're tightening, like something about your whole shoulder. Probably what you're going to see is your whole shoulder is going to grip up somehow, like, and it'll become clear if you think about it, that you're probably doing a whole lot more effort and a whole lot more, I don't know, things that you didn't really know that you were doing just to move along the table. You know, you just called it tightening, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, not just investigating, but actually you can actually identify and prevent all that unnecessary activity.
Yeah. So
we're not treating the thing. We're not trying to figure out specific muscles. We're not trying to figure out which ones to tighten, which ones to loosen. We're actually looking at an activity where we interfere and learning not to interfere.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could do that in the prone position. That's one of the most primitive and most supported. So it's a really nice position just to explore very kind of primitive limb movements on the floor, almost like flipper movements that correspond to the, you know, Piscean stage.
Yeah.
But you could also, you could do that progressively to more complex postures. So doing that in a four-footed posture is really useful.
Yeah.
Because very few adults are capable of crawling on all fours without using extreme amount of tension in the back, neck, thighs, shoulders, etc.
Yeah.
And if you look at how a two-year-old does that, there's no evidence in a typical two-year-old that's crawling on all fours, there's no evidence that they're using all that unnecessary tension.
Yeah.
We develop all kinds of interferences, and we could actually identify them and relearn how to do crawling in a much more coordinated way.
Yeah.
And we could do that progressively to clambering until we're standing and using our arms back to the table here with much less effort.
Yeah.
So developmental movement is a way of it's kind of a science of kinesthetic awareness where you could study progressive actions from simple to more complex and learn how to restore, how to prevent the interference so that we can do these things much more effortlessly and more consciously.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see how, you know, I can see how the idea that we, you know, we do something with an unnecessary amount of tightening or force or gripping or whatever, that kind of thing is at least somewhat familiar to people who do things like swing a baseball bat and they want to do it well because their coaches are like, saying you're gripping the bat too hard, or you're lifting your shoulder when you swing, you don't have to do that. And they're always sort of telling you, you know, either relax or hold the bat a different way, or watch how that guy does it. You know, he doesn't lift his shoulder, he's practiced a lot. Or, you know, the same thing with like a violinist. You know, like watch them, you know, they don't sort of arch their necks and, you know, their shoulders when they lift it up, you know, like relax your shoulder in order to lift. So this is somewhat familiar, I think, to people who want to do skilled activities like this, like those. I don't think it's as familiar even to those people that we could investigate all of the other things that we do, even the simplest act, like moving your hand and forearm along the table, like you just said. There's, in the same way that like a violinist who might actually pay attention to these things when they're practicing, they might not realize that's how they do whatever it is that they want to do, including get up out of a chair, or including like, you know, getting in this sort of like primitive reptile-like posture and moving their hand along the ground, you know? Almost like I just want to put a stamp in that, like this, you know, the notion that we perhaps unskillfully do these things, meaning, you know, we give a whole lot more effort, it carries over into how we do everything, not just how we do skilled things.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. We don't realize that if we have a shoulder problem, there's a very, very good chance that it's because of how we're doing it that we're having the shoulder problem. We don't connect the fact that we might have stiffness in the shoulder with what we're actually doing in an activity. But if you're studying this, you will see it. But this applies to the violinist as well. The violinist might appreciate a little more, perhaps, than someone who doesn't use the arms in a skilled activity that they're aware of, you know, that they're working on. It may not occur to them that it matters, but and maybe the violinist cares a bit more. But the violinist doesn't have a way of looking at it either. Right. So the musician's having trouble. They'll say, well, I'm trying to pay attention to my technique. I'm trying not to raise my arms so much. I'm trying to relax. But that's not going to help. For the musician who grows up playing, you know, holding a violin, holding the bow, has never been shown how the shoulders work and how not to interfere with them.
Yeah.
And developmental movement is a way of studying that.
Yeah. 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 Studying it from, you know, no pun intended, studying it from the ground level.
Yeah.
You know, really, if you want to really study this and, you know, like, you know, the violinist is almost the extreme case. If they want to study how they're holding the violin, studying this is the way to do it. You know, you have to see how you do things, even the simplest acts, and it behooves you to learn how to make use of primitive postures like this in order to get the muscles releasing a little bit, so that, you know, like you said before, we get sort of a baseline that you can compare the amount of tightening that you bring into activities. Yeah. So this is a whole science of action.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the simplistic version of the Alexander technique where someone, you know, the violinist comes to the teacher and says, hey, my shoulder's hurting me. The teacher says, yeah, well, you're tightening your neck and pulling your head back, and I can show you how to stop pulling your head back and use your arms a little, you know, more easily. That's not getting at the whole problem. There's a theory and you have to have real knowledge about how the shoulders, if you're going to help the violinist properly, you have to know how that system works. You have to know something about how to restore it. And then you have to go back to the activity, like holding a bow and playing the violin, and look at how we interfere so that we're able to restore the natural working of the shoulders, and then we're able to prevent the interference that originally put them wrong, got in the way.
You know,
and that's a more meaningful way of looking at it. Yeah.
So clearly there's a lot to say about practice, about how somebody could use primitive postures and positions, what it's for. You just sort of laid out a whole, you know, like a, you know, like a larger look at the goals of the practice itself. And it's really interesting. And of course, you know, we really can't go into the practical demonstrations here because of the limitations, but, you know, we just wanted to say again that we offer classes at the Diamond Institute. We're going to have one upcoming October 20th. It's going to start then. You can find the information on diamondinstitute.org. We've got other classes available, other videos available there, pieces of reading that are available for free. So always check that out. But Ted, you want to say anything more about maybe next episode? Or?
Yeah, I thought maybe the next episode we could discuss this idea that when you're doing a progressive sequence of movement exploration, it looks as if you're sort of going back to the beginning, but you really can't go back to the beginning because we're a fully formed, complex, upright human being. So I thought it'd be interesting to discuss the idea that we are, how we approach the progression from primitive to complex as a fully formed adult, you know, human, and what that means as a theory and sort of an interesting idea of the, how we embody a larger complex system.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah.
That'd be great. I really look forward to that. Yeah, and so we're going to continue that episode might not be titled Developmental Movement Part 5 or whatever it is, but like we are going to continue this conversation related to developmental movement because it's just so rich, as you can see. You know, we've already spoken so much about it, but there's so much more to say. But please tune in, like and subscribe. It helps us out on YouTube and on any other platform. Write a review. And we'll see you next episode. Thanks for watching. Thanks for the discussion, Ted.
Thank you, James. Thank you, everyone.